Welcome back to Transmission. Today, Q sits down with Evan Karen. In this conversation, you'll hear how Montauk's venture studio approach has spun out 10 companies in just 2 years, tackling everything from power quality insurance to grid-enhancing technologies. Evan also shares the story behind Electron X and explains why our aging power grids are struggling to keep up with AI demands and renewable energy integration. It's an eye-opening discussion about the intersection of energy and venture capital. Want the latest news, analysis, and price indices from power markets around the globe delivered to your inbox every week? Subscribe to the Weekly Dispatch, Moda Energy's email newsletter. Now, let's jump into the conversation.
Evan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get stuck in then. So Montauk Capital, what is it?
We're a venture studio and we build platforms around ideas that we think need to exist in the kind of combination of the electron economy, which is the term that we coined was really around the convergence of all things electricity, all things energy infrastructure. And fundamentally, there was a lot of businesses that were disparate and now they're all coming and converging. So it's the convergence of all things around in and around electricity.
And just so our audience understand, you've got a bit of a different approach to building companies at Montauk Climate. So rather than a typical incubator where entrepreneurs apply to be part of the incubator and you fund them and you help them get off the ground, it's almost the other way around, that you come up with the ideas and build the companies very successfully and build the management teams and go and take markets, right?
Yes.
So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we thought that there was a kind of a break in the traditional venture model where, you know, founders show up, they grind for a year or two, they try to find co-founders, they try to go raise money. We saw a break in this category because electricity, energy, commodity, infrastructure is extremely nuanced. It requires subject matter expertise. And we felt like there was a better way to build businesses in this category, in this sector. By way of background, I worked at Sidewalk Infrastructure Partners for a while, for about a year. They do, their model is based on these thematic sprints where they go very deep on an idea. They build conviction in that idea. They build a management team and they go spin that up. At Riverstone, where I was a venture investor, the original idea for Riverstone was Riverstone Ventures or Riverstone Studio, where we would come up with ideas that would disrupt the Riverstone portfolio, and Riverstone employees would basically run those businesses.
Wow!
And so that was the original concept. I always had this model kind of in the back of my head, and I was lucky enough to meet Philip Krim, who started Casper, who has a ton of experience in scaling and launching venture businesses, is a very successful investor.
For our European friends, Casper is pretty much the number one direct-to-customer mattress company in the US. So if you your mattress in a box, the whole thing was pretty much started by Casper.
Yes.
And if you're European, that's what an Emma mattress is in the US. And they're really popular for dog beds as well. My dog's got a Casper bed that he loves.
And yeah, through that process, he learned everything from, how to operate high functioning teams, how to operate through adversity, how to take companies public, how to take them private, M&A, venture. And so he brings a really nuanced approach and a different approach to this category. And so Venture Studio, we go very deep on ideas. We do deep exploration, deep research. We underwrite core themes in this market, whether it's compute, whether it's digital infrastructure, whether it's accounting systems, ERP, AI, physical infrastructure, moving away from hydrocarbons into the electron economy. We recruit custom teams and co-founders to lead those businesses that have deep subject matter expertise. We fund those companies as long as they need to be funded. We build the platforms and we scale them up and roll them off the balance sheet. And we've done that now 10 times over the last 2 years. We've hired 10 CEOs, probably 20, 30 executives, have raised capital for almost half of those companies already, and the other half are coming to market pretty soon. And it spans everything from insurance to space to data centers to cryptography to AI to digital infrastructure to ERP systems and everything else in between.
But before we talk about that, because there's so much to talk about, if you wouldn't mind, many of our listeners will know Electron X. Of course, you founded Electron X. Could you just talk about that and that journey for a few minutes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because very impressive company and has come a long, long way.
Absolutely, yeah. So I've been in the energy markets since 2003. I started my career at Morgan Stanley managing power plants. I got obsessed with electricity because it was such a complex asset class. I didn't even know coming into that job day one, I didn't know that you could trade power. Like I didn't think it was a, you know, I grew up watching Wall Street and Trading Places, and you know, I knew, you know, pork bellies and frozen concentrated oranges. I think trading.
Just by the way, that film has not aged well, has it? I just, it's still hilarious, but I cannot believe. Just a different time, wasn't it? Wow.
But a classic.
But a classic. Yes, don't get me wrong, it's still a classic. But I put it on, I know, I found it on a DVD in an Airbnb that we stayed in about 5 years ago. We put it on, and it was just so funny, but I just can't believe they got away with it.
They did, for sure. And again, I mean, the cast is amazing, right?
Yeah,
So growing up, I always loved the trading world. And so I found myself in a weird role at Morgan Stanley. I was in the middle office and back office, and it's really hard to make the jump from a back office, middle office person that's doing debits and credits on the accounting, in the accounting group to a trader. And so I spent about 2 or 3 years figuring out how to get to the front office, and I got bit by that bug and haven't turned back, right? And learning about electricity derivatives, learning about complex power flows and congestion and transmission and power assets was just it turned into an obsession. And for 10 years, I sat on Wall Street trading complex electricity books, mainly in ERCOT. I was an early user of ICE. I was an early user of Nodal Exchange. I was an early user of NGX, which was an exchange managing physical commodities. I was involved in everything from credit to trading to counterparty novations. We did a lot of structuring and transactions. And so end to end, the trading business was known, soup to nuts. And in 2017, I helped Sean Kelly and Abe start Amperon, which is like the large load forecasting business, an AI company.
Another awesome business.
Yeah. I mean, Sean's been a friend for 15, 20 years. And so I was in the room when they came up with the idea. I was asked to be co-founder. I was already CEO of another platform and kind of had to see that thing through, which was a platform called ClearTrace. And I always had this idea that the ICE platform was just, it's a exchange for the big institutional traders.
Large. Oh yeah, you can't sit at the table without serious capital.
Yeah, and when we first started, it was very easy to get an FCM. It was easy to start a book.
What's an FCM?
FCM is like a financial clearing merchant. So you can't be an exchange member. FCMs are the exchange member, and so if you trade on ICE, you're not actually an ICE member. You go through an FCM. FCM is your agent, and they provide credit, they provide clearing, they provide accounting. They're like a prime broker, and at the time, the power volatility was not very high, and so it was very cheap to get an ICE account. Like you posted a couple $100,000, and you can start trading. After 2011 in ERCOT, when prices exploded, and after 2018, the price, the entry ticket to get an FCM went from a couple $100,000 to like $50 million, and so it cut out I was running Trailstone's trading business on their electricity side for years, and we created services businesses to help renewables that have no balance sheet and smaller C&I customers access the market. We were kind of the agent, and we were taking a fee. We were taking anywhere between $1 and $6 a megawatt hour for every transaction that we facilitated. And that's how the banks made money on their mid-marketing business and their origination business. So the thesis for Electron X was we need more democratization of this market. And that was just the original concept, democratization of electricity markets. It just so happens that the electricity markets were also going through a massive once-in-a-generation transformation. We went from spinning reserves and power plants that had inertia to renewables and inverter-based grid. At the time, we were retiring assets. Coal plants were going away every day. We were losing natural gas assets. The nuclear fleet was gone, right? Everyone was talking about retiring nuclear. And power volatility was still in its kind of like, we'll call it its infancy, but we weren't seeing a ton of volatility. Then the world changed, right? We got gigawatts of batteries. We got tens of thousands of megawatts of solar, intermittent resources, demand response, demand side management, natural gas pricing, and data centers. The data centers is kind of like the big aha moment. High performance compute changed everything. And we started seeing like little bits and pieces of this market emerge. We saw Voltus and Enernoc on their demand response side. We saw what Caruso was doing on Bitcoin mining and curtailing loads during high peak periods. We saw what MP2 was doing. We saw what Amperon was doing around 4CP management. And we said, we should build an exchange that focuses on everyone else, not Vistra and NRG. Of course, they'll hopefully participate, but it's really around the renewables,
the smaller players,
the renewable providers, the battery operators. And so we said, why don't we actually build a CFTC exchange, CFTC regulated derivatives exchange that enabled access to the market, democratized access to the market in a fully KYC compliant way. And so Philip and I had the idea originally. We always knew we weren't going to run the business because we always wanted to be kind of the advisors and board members and investors functionally. And so we spent about 6 months trying to find a CEO that shared our vision, understood high frequency trading, understood the market dynamics, could run a business. And we met Sam, who's the CEO now and is running the show. And he's doing an incredible job. And he's been able to get great partners and great investors. And you know, once the CFTC approves the exchange, it's, you know, hopefully going to fundamentally change how electricity is managed, how it's traded, how it's settled. And it should usher in kind of like the next phase of commodity exposures for electricity markets.
And is the vision for Electron-X to move liquidity to Electron-X from existing exchanges? Or is it to create a new pool of liquidity for the folks who couldn't afford the buy-in?
Yeah, and again, just for like full disclosure, I'm not on the board. I'm a helpful advisor and a meaningful shareholder. I think in general, it's an abundance opportunity. I think the goal is to not necessarily try to take market share from ICE or nodal exchange, but really around there's so many market participants that need to go through a middleman. They need to go through a retail energy provider. They need to go through a EMA desk. I think that's where you see some significant growth and growth in customers that don't hedge at all, right? They just take whatever the market gives them. They're index customers, and they don't know their exposure. I think that's where we see just an incredible amount of new market and new flow and new liquidity that didn't exist before.
So let's switch lanes then to go back to Montauk Climate, where you have an entity that is creating 10 plus ideas at the moment that you're hiring a management team to go and build businesses in. And you covered a broad range there across, you know, power, renewables, but also space and data and infrastructure. Could you just give a couple of examples of the companies that are being set up as part of that? And then I really want to ask you about the grid infrastructure theme, because you went pretty hard at the grid infrastructure theme.
Yeah, I would say that we initially started with grid infrastructure as being one of the biggest challenges that the U.S. was going to face over the next 10 years. And it's because of all of the data points, right? We have a aging transmission infrastructure. We have new load profiles. We have dynamic load profiles. We have high-performance compute. We have wind and solar. We have inverter-based systems. We have new SMRs showing up. We have repowering of old assets. We have load growth in areas we never had load growth before. We have extreme weather events. And so all that kind of culminated in this thesis around, it's not just about power quantity, it's about power quality. And the first company we incubated was a platform called Adaptive Insurance. And the idea around Adaptive Insurance was to create insurance for small and medium-sized businesses that were negatively impacted by climate-related events, so like severe weather. And the first product we launched, and it's a first of its kind, was a power outage protection policy, where if your power goes out for any reason, whether somebody, you know, hits the transmission line or there's a weather event and it goes out for a period of time, you get paid. It's a policy that pays you out. And so if you're a bar, a restaurant, if you've got spoilage, if your refrigerator goes down, and it's a data-driven platform. They use data, they use intelligence, they're able to validate that the power went out for the specific period of time, and they pay you immediately. There's no claims process. It's a parametric insurance policy. And the first policy—
Which is basically a derivative, right? Everything is a derivative.
Well, it's a derivative, but in the eyes of the regulator, it's a non-admitted insurance product. And it has to be sold through insurance brokers and insurance agents, and it's an insurance product. It's not a derivative in the fact that, like, you put on a trade and it's regulated by the CFTC or it's regulated by, you know, a trading organization, because it's an at-risk product. It's a risk-reducing product, and it's classified as an insurance product. And so, if the power goes out and you have coverage, you get paid. And if you lose income because you're a restaurant owner and the power's out, you can't pay your employees and your food goes bad, we cover that. If you're a beer garden in Austin and it rains all week, we're going to be covering that. If it's we're going to be looking at all climate perils, from flood to fire to hail to snow. Power outages is probably the most complicated, because it's kind of the there's a ton of covariance risk in weather to power. But the idea was power quality was a problem across the U.S. Power outages cost small and medium sized businesses $50-100 billion a year in losses. And so huge market, huge opportunity, underwrites the thesis around power quality, underwrites the thesis that we had around resiliency, and allows it to express a view in a CapEx light way.
Very, very cool.
And the CEO of that platform was the first 10 employees at Hippo. So understood high growth insurtech solutions. That platform just got reinsurance capacity, launched in July, already got customers. It's off to the races. We think that's one that's going to be hopefully a really big platform. It's Austin-based as well.
Shout out to Austin, of course.
That's right.
Well, let's do another one then. Tell us about another one of those businesses in the group.
So we have a again, speaking to the theme around power quality, one of the biggest
power quality is one of my favorite subjects, by the way. It's just a very niche and very important thing.
Yes.
And yeah, you have anything to do with inverter systems, spend a lot of time thinking about it.
So we, strangely enough, through research or some stumble, like, you know, there used to be a website called StumbleUpon where you just
Yeah, that's such a good website. There's obviously no need for it anymore.
Yeah, but
it was like a Chrome plugin that had this little thing. Chrome plugin where you press, if you're ever bored on the internet before the search was around, but it was kind of rubbish.
Yes.
You just press StumbleUpon, it would take you to this like magnificent website about, I don't know, anime and forests.
Anything.
Or
yes.
Like,
yes.
I don't know, how a bridge is constructed. It was great.
So through some stumble upon inspiration, we stumble upon an article that Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners, which is an investment platform here in the US, they were developing a synchronous condenser in the UK. And it's like, wait, they're spec developing a synchronous condenser? Like, what's the point? Like, why don't you just put a battery in? And at the time I was scratching my head, I'm like, they're clearly thinking about power quality problem. They're going to sell an ancillary service, or they're going to sell a grid stability service to the utility, because there's clearly a problem. And like, again, it's like one piece of copper wire up there. It's a slightly different model, but we started to see the cracks in issues around reactive power flow, voltage droop. And I've been a power trader for a long time. What the ISOs used to do in the T&D companies is they would say, oh, we've got a problem here. Let's just derate the lines. Let's we know there's going to be a voltage issue here because of some grid topology issue, an outage, a generator outage, a transmission outage, some construction, et cetera. So we'll just derate the line. We don't have to worry about it. And so they created these generic transmission constraints. They created remedial action plans. And they said, if we get a voltage problem, we'll just derate the line, and it makes the grid really inefficient, right? Because you've got all this fixed infrastructure, you've got all this N-1 contingency everywhere, and all they do is just derate the line. And it's a cost to consumers because it causes congestion. And so there's a whole cost issue around consumers are paying more for the infrastructure. But we also saw through the last couple months, we've seen issues in Virginia around data centers tripping offline or potentially causing cascading issues. And then the big aha moment was the Portugal and Spain blackout. And we said to ourselves that the transmission grid has been focused too much on power quantity and not enough on power quality. And so what are the technologies that exist today and what technologies need to be developed to support grid-enhancing technologies? They call them GETs. And these are devices like FACTS, like synchronous condensers, like static compensators. Some people are working on solid state transformers, but the whole idea is that the power grid was designed for a completely different set of assets than exist today. So we had a power grid that was inertia based, spinning reserve based, where power was generated at the transmission level and delivered to the distribution level. And it was on demand, it was dispatchable. You hit a button, it went up, you hit a button, it goes down. And the load and the demand side was predictable. It was hot, load goes up, it's cold, load goes down in the summer and vice versa in the winter. And the way that the grids were operating, you could operate with debits and credits, and it worked. That's not the case anymore. And so we are quietly launching a platform that is with the intent on helping grid operators, transmit T&D companies, renewable developers, data center developers, enhance their voltage characteristics, reactive power flow characteristics, so that they can operate as better actors on the transmission grid. Rather than the utility saying, we're going to have to constrain everything, we're basically bringing our own MVARs to the equation. And so if we can do that, the assets become much more grid aware, much more grid integrated, and the utility companies, the transmission companies, won't have to push back on saying, you know what, we can't handle your asset because of one reason or another.
And so this is at the load. So this is at a data center, or this is, you know,
how in front of the meter, could be behind the meter, but it's really around identifying the right types of resources that will support new load or new generation in the existing transmission system, rather than a utility coming back and saying, you know what, we'll be able to interconnect you in 7 years because we need to build a new substation, new capacitor banks, new transformers, new infrastructure. It's how do we leverage the existing infrastructure to make your asset compatible with your location? That's kind of the big idea around power quality. Power quantity, you still got to find those electrons. But it's how can we make your asset perform better and be less of a strain or less of a drain on the utility resources? And so you're already starting to see this happen in the software side. Obviously, Google, Emerald AI, which is a company that launched, was talking about throttling data center load to make it more utility aware. This is really around pulling through data and awareness on what's going on in the transmission system. So this overlays into dynamic line ratings. This overlays into companies like Splyte, which are doing more AI-based algorithmic line management or transparency in what's actually going on in the transmission grid. It's very much a play on that theme.
Yeah, I think actually on my bingo card for the next few years, I think the world is underestimating the amount of flexibility that's going to come from data centers. There's an assumption that because they're critical infrastructure and they needed a lot of uptime, that they are uncurtailable.
Yep.
But that's not the truth. That's not really how it works. And there's a lot of flexibility available in these data centers, which I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about.
We're actually working on a company that is also coming out of stealth that is very well positioned to manage that flexibility. And it's doing it in a way that is not on the hardware side. It's doing the way in how jobs are routed to the data centers and what hardware should be. It's basically, I don't want to underestimate the complexity, but the idea is not every job is positioned for every piece of hardware. And if you can control how hardware is provisioned and spooled up and managed, you can increase the level of flexibility of those data centers. Not on the design side, so not about HVAC and liquid cooling and PUE, but really around managing inference and managing training workloads and managing Kubernetes clusters and figuring out how to do it before it gets to the data center. That's kind of the idea. More of MCP orchestration layer for AI.
Yeah, because not all compute is real time. Not all compute is required now. A lot of it can be batched or done overnight, or, you know,
there's a company called Run.ai, which was acquired by NVIDIA, and they're a scheduler. They're a compute scheduler. We're building an intelligent compute scheduler. We hired an amazing CEO. We should be in market. We're in piloting with a number of customers now. They love it. They say it's saving them money. It's saving them time. It's a hybrid MLOps scheduler platform. And again, it plays into, like you're saying, you're a climate company, you're Montauk Climate. Why are you building an AI auto scheduler? It's all touch, like that's why it all plays into this theme. It's a catch-all of electron economies. It impacts how you manage your resources. So if you can build a more aware data center, then you could build a less energy intensive data center. You might be able to build in a different place. So you think about, you're reframing everything and you basically take a commons approach to everything. Everything has, if you think about everything, might be resource constrained, and you use it in the lens of electron. You rethink PUE profiles. You rethink how you manage compute, how you build a data center. We launched a platform called Grid Free that's building off-grid data centers. Again, same reason. We think that the grid is challenged. We think time to market is important. We think data centers historically were managed as a real estate business and a land business. Data centers are power plants now. They're utilities. You have to rethink how you build a data center, how you design a data center, how you optimize a data center, how you operate a data center. And there's tons of companies that are building, you know, picks and shovels across the landscape. You've got compute marketplaces now. You've got platforms like Emerald AI. You've got platforms like Tapestry. You've got platforms like Recurve. They're all trying to figure out how to like build software to connect to hardware, connect to business models. It's such an exciting time. And it's like now we want to build winners in that space too.
Let me ask you about the word climate, because it's in your name, Montauk Climate, but climate's had a bit of a rough ride the last few years. So what do you think about that?
I think it's a backlash against ESG mandates and specific, ESG was a catch-all, like environmental, social, and governance. And so, you know, yes, there was an overallocation in rigid frameworks that overallocated capital to potentially bad ideas because they had an ESG lens to them or they had an ESG positioning. When I think of climate, I don't think of climate change. I think I guess we can call it Montauk Earth. We can call it Montauk, resources. You know, I mean, it's how you view the word climate. I think most investors who invested in climate were ESG investors. There's a lot of philanthropic capital that went through it, and there's a lot of clean tech. We're not necessarily a clean tech business. We're not necessarily a business that is focused on a specific target for carbon reduction. I think the things that we think about is related to, if I probably had the ability to rename the company, we would have probably started as Montauk Commons, which is like thinking about everything in a commons mindset, right? Like Eleanor Ostrom style. I think we probably would have done that, but it might've been a bit too, no one really understands it. Like unless you've studied economics and studied, you know, what commonses are and tragedy of commons. I think, there are still a lot of investors that care about sustainability, that care about rethinking how we manage resources. And so climate at the time, you know, was not as so polarizing. I'm glad we didn't call it Montauk Carbon, right? But we like the name. It's kind of still catchy. It still rolls off. Like, we're building businesses of real consequence. And I think, you know, we could call ourselves, you know, Montauk Sewer. And I think we're fine.
sewers are sexy again now.
That's right. Yeah. Waste management. I think, you know, again, there's a political lens to climate because it's got that negative connotation with ESG. I think there's, again, a lot of businesses didn't survive because they required concessionary capital, which is, you know, money that just is pouring in, whether it's a good business model or not. And I think for us, we're not attached to requiring concessionary capital or philanthropic venture to make these business models work. What Philip says, and the way that he coined it, was pragmatic companies of consequence. And so these are businesses that are standalone businesses that can make money. The fact that it does have a climate angle to it allows us to operate with a broader aperture. So we're incubating something in the water space around water scarcity and atmospheric water generators. We think that that's a technology that has a distribution problem, not a technology problem. And so that allows us, if we were just Montauk Electricity or Montauk Energy, we would really limit our ability to kind of get out there and do things that also check like the emotional box. Like if we can create reduce water scarcity globally in either the global south or areas where there's a drought stricken or water issues, like that checks pulls on my heartstrings and allows us to still maintain us to be climate positive. We're not going to do anything climate negative. Like we're not going to go drill for coal. We're not going to go and meaningfully pollute, try to overfish fisheries and destroy ecosystems. And so like, we're just, yes, we're actively thinking about how to leverage the climate angle without towing the line of like an ESG company or a company that requires concessionary capital.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation. So then going back to data centers, which is clearly a core thesis, and it is one of the defining aspects of the electrification wave right now. If you're allocating capital to companies, do we have to worry about there being a bubble here? Will all of these, you know, will the load that we expect, it's a bit of a loaded question because we've spent a lot of time looking into this and thinking about it as well, but what do you think about load growth and data center build out? And do you think we're at risk of a bubble here?
I think very similar to early technology transitions, there are bubbles inside of a larger bubble, or there are assets that are overpriced relative to the growth in the market. Do I think we're going to slow down on the AI of everything? No, I think everything's going to have AI powered, whether we're going to have hardware at the edge in your phone that's going to be able to do really like 4-bit computation, and your spell check's not going to go into the cloud. It's going to go, and your grammar check is going to be on your phone, and eventually like all the translation services and all the things, like your AR is not going to be cloud. It's going to be edge. The inference workloads around IoT and autonomous driving and autonomous aviation and some of the high complex workloads that require inference, they're going to be cloud or fog or edge. And then you have the training workloads and some of the more computationally intensive things like LLMs and training and the hardware the hardware mix that we're going to see is not just going to be NVIDIA H100s. We're going to see similar to application-specific circuits like Bitcoin miners. We're going to see hardware that is going to evolve to not be generalist but specialist. The things that cause me pause in the kind of the everything up and to the right forever is that we're not going to be able to build all 11,000 megawatt hyperscaler sites, like Fervo Energy or Fermi Energy is 11,000 megawatts. Stargate, 5,000 megawatts. Meta and Facebook, 5,000 megawatt hyperclusters in these giant clusters. I think what we're going to see is...
But some of those are committed to build, right?
They're committed to build, but not the whole thing. Yeah. Like everybody talks about the big headline number. They don't talk about the phases to get there. Nope. If I told you I've got 100% conviction that I'm going to build a 50 megawatt data center, that's not going to get any headlines at all. Even if I have amazing technology and I'm using geothermal and I'm carbon sequestration and I'm doing all the things, 50 megawatts doesn't move the needle anymore. It's only everybody's just bragawatts again. I do think that there's a bubble in land. And I think the powered land bubble is going to burst. And the reason is there's only 7 or 8 companies that can sign the long-term leases that allow you to actually construct, finance, and develop these projects.
That are credit worthy.
An AI company that's scaling to $100 million of ARR that has $500 million of cost, they can't sign a 20-year PP, 20-year lease. There might only be a dozen, maybe more,
It's a little bit WeWorky.
That's right. And so powered land has you've got a lot of land banks and you've got a lot of powered land plays. And I just give it an anecdotal example. One of my friends runs procurement for a large data center colo provider. And he's like, hey, I've got 17 sites 17 locations and markets that I'm looking for. And I call CBRE, and CBRE sent me a list of 17,000 megawatts for what they want of 200. They want 250 megawatt site. And they have 17,000 powered land assets just in one state in Pennsylvania. And they all say power available 2028, 2029, permits, land acquisition, 500 acres near a substation with water, with fiber. There's too many of those. And I think that the market might have overestimated the ability to actually get the power to the site, B, the value of that real estate. It's they can't all be data centers. Before they were warehouses, they were 3PL facilities, they were Amazon distribution facilities, they were Whole Foods cold storage. If you got a Whole Foods cold storage facility in your industrial park, you crushed it. Now everybody's waiting for Amazon, Meta, Facebook, Google, CoreWeave, or Microsoft to lease that land. And there's just There's not that many, like, and you've got every market in the country wanting the same thing. So everybody wants to build in the tier one markets. People went nuts. They went into tier three markets where nobody lives. And they say, well, I need power. Now they're coming back and saying, you know what? Honestly, I just want the best sites near load areas that have no flood risk and that I can get power, I can get gas, I can build behind the meter. And so I think that the bubble is not necessarily in, are we going to build more data centers? I think if you look at the number of data center interconnection agreements and you look at, it's the same thing with batteries.
It's the same thing with batteries. Yeah.
Yeah. And we saw how many interconnection agreements for batteries are in ERCOT? 100,000 megawatts more? Yeah. How many are actually going to get built? 5%, maybe 10%, maybe. I just don't think we're going to see that as
Batteries, inverted commas, but it is simpler for batteries because you don't need gas for on-site generation. You don't need water. You don't need fiber. You can get fiber, but it should be a little bit simpler for batteries. But then you do have the second order effect that then the technology becomes the bad guy, right? So in the newspapers, it becomes, you know, the whole system is clogged with data center applications. So the whole system is clogged with battery applications. And it's not the asset class itself that's the problem. It is the market.
Developers, people want to make money, right? And you make a lot of money. If you take a raw piece of land and just orders of magnitude, you take a raw piece of land and you entitle it and you do the work, you make a lot of money, get rich. I mean, Caruso has got a $10 billion value. They're raising $1 billion and $10 billion valuation. Lancium, they got in early with Bitcoin and they got a bunch of powered land, Cloverleaf infrastructure, powered land plays. I do think that not all those projects are going to pencil. I think there's going to be a lot of at-risk capital that just gets kind of lit on fire. And I think the land price is a bit bubbly. I think that's the big bubble. And I don't know if there's no burst because these are long-term landowners. And so like, it doesn't create like a cascading issue. Like if Nvidia stock dropped 50% tomorrow, that would just, you know, but you see like how sensitive the market is. Like Sam Altman comes out and says, I think AI might be a little bubbly, or MIT comes out with an article saying, you know, Gen AI has negative ROI. And you see the markets, they're so, it's everything's on a hair trigger right now. I think when you look at,
We've got Nvidia earnings today. They're going to crush it.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, they have an unlimited demand, right? I mean, they are a behemoth, and everyone keeps buying. I think if you look at some of the companies that have been doing this a long time, they are saying to themselves, "Why am I going to increase supply? Like, I don't know if this is real. I don't know if this is going to persist." And when you talk to, and they could either be right or completely, it's a binary outcome. Like they're either wrong or they're wrong and they missed it, or they're right and they know this is just like every other super cycle or every other, cycle of like, you know, if you look at that curve, like that you see every time, like you see that, like that adoption curve or that S curve or whatever that curve is, where you look, you know, they say it every time crypto drops or every time the market drops, it's like, you've got this like irrational exuberance, the market peaks, and then you have a valley of despair, and then people start capitulating. Like it's the same. It's emotional. It's not a rational market right now. It seems irrational. And I think when you look at folks that are really, really smart in this industry, you can make the claim that AI is going to eat everything. And if you believe that story, then everything I just said means nothing, right? Because, you know, we're going to have machines talking to machines, and it's going to be Terminator, and like the whole thing is going to, you know, humans aren't going
to
exist.
You talk to SoftBank about it. We haven't even got started, right?
Yes. Yeah. So they're saying we're in first inning. But that also flies in the face of like the fact that like, you know, they say like Javon's paradox and whatever else is going to get cheaper and people are just going to use more of it. What happens, and like the counter argument of my contrarian view is that what happens if there's a breakthrough in the physics and there's a breakthrough in the code and the software and the DeepSeek moment, whether DeepSeek's real or not, if there's a moment where they are able to modify how transformers manage LLMs and neural nets, and they're saying, you know what? We don't need as much compute. Maybe we don't need it all. Maybe we only need a quarter of it. Maybe we only need a half of it. If any of that is true, where things are going to get even more efficient, where you're going to be able to have LPUs TPUs, the tensor processing units like Grok, whether you're going to move to neuromorphic computing, whether all the really heavy stuff is going to go quantum, well, then maybe you don't need 11 gigawatts in a hypercluster.
I have the same, it's an adjacent contrarian view that I always come back to, and I'm sure some of our listeners aren't going to like this, but I'm not sure I believe the EV charger growth story, because you have a similar thing, right? Which is that when cars can only do 100 miles with a charge, it totally makes sense that you need a load of EV chargers on you know, motorway or freeway services. But when chargers, when cars can do 600 or 700 miles, there is literally no need for them.
No.
And do you think it's going to stop at 700 miles in a car? No, we've only just got started.
That's right.
We're going to be beyond 1,000 miles in a saloon this decade, right? So
yes.
Why would you ever bother paying a premium for a service station? And I think the same thing, yeah, you could have this, you could make the same argument with, I've got a friend who always talks about this, who's really bearish on Bitcoin, and talks about quantum computing basically taking Bitcoin's lunch. I don't really believe it personally.
Yeah,
but
I think that I have an opinion there. And so the algorithm that maintains Bitcoin is pretty secure from a quantum perspective. The wallets aren't. And so the biggest risk is post-quantum wallets need to be implemented immediately. So if I was running the Bitcoin Foundation, I would say every wallet from here on out, because it's very easy to build a post-quantum encrypted wallet, every wallet from here on out needs to be post-quantum. And then all you have to worry about is Satoshi's balance, and then everyone else is fine. Move your money from the existing wallet infrastructure to post-wallet encryption, and then the algorithm that, it's basically called Crystals Dilithium is the NIST-approved post-quantum encrypted wallet infrastructure. If you move your coins there, you probably have nothing to worry about.
But it all comes back to this thing, which is that this boom and bust is about technology S curves.
That's right.
And GPUs are going through the same thing, and battery cells are going through the same thing, and elsewhere. And it's very difficult to see where the vertical bit starts and finishes.
That's right.
It can go on a lot longer than you think.
That's right. And they're saying like the depreciation cycle on some of these GPUs is like,
oh, yeah,
it's crazy.
It's like,
I mean, so where's
8 months or something, right?
That's right. And so like there, it's just again, I don't want to call a top in the market, and everyone else who has, it's gotten blown through. I just think that if you take a healthy view of skepticism, you can still be long in the right places, and maybe you miss the next kind of like leg up in growth, but you're still going to be able to take advantage of these opportunities. And that's why we started Montauk Climate. That's why I'm not a public equities trader. Not all of these things need to be true for us to build real businesses that are going to take advantage of transition and transition times. And so in periods of high volatility, where there's contrarian views of boom and bust cycles, you want to be in this stage of the business, early stage, where you're not banking on one specific outcome to be true. So for us, increased adoption of batteries, great. We're going to have a different problem to solve. Aging infrastructure. Hey, again, the assets are not getting any younger. They're getting older. They're going to have to be replaced. What are they going to be replaced with? They're going to be replaced with natural gas. They're going to be replaced with storage. They're going to be replaced with solar. They're going to be replaced with nuclear. What happens with nuclear? Okay, what are we going to do with the waste? What about new fuels, TRISO fuels? How are nuclear plants going to be developed? Who's going to develop them? Where's the infrastructure going to come from? Where's the training going to come from? When we start picking up when we start pulling on these threads, anytime we go through a period of rapid change, there's so much opportunity. It's just a massive white space because we don't know what comes after the fold. And so that's why we're betting on a bunch of different plays that all have high levels of conviction that whether AI is a 100,000 megawatt market or a 40,000 megawatt market, we still do well. If it's a 500,000 megawatt market, we probably should be building chips or getting involved in metals and supply chain because we don't have enough. So that's our view.
Yeah, I mean, just even those references, you know, even if it's only 15, 20 gigs, which is on the low side for what load growth forecasts are, even another 15 gigs in ERCOT, things start to fall apart.
Absolutely.
and it could get a lot crazier.
And we haven't even talked about LNG. I do think LNG is still going to be a thing. And I don't think, you know, natural gas resources in the U.S. are massively undervalued. I think, you know, if I was going to make a call on where the future of natural gas goes, it should go up. I don't think it should be going down. There's a weird situation in the forward markets. When you look at commodity markets in the US, the forward power market is not up and to the right in any market. It's still backward. It's basically backwardated, and natural gas is basically free. So somebody is saying, like, either there's a lot of resources coming, or there's the load is not real.
Yeah. Or that we're coming to the end of the business cycle.
That's right.
And there will be some sort of demand industrial
reset.
That's right.
And then they're waiting to buy.
Yeah.
I spoke to an unnamed private equity group a couple of weeks ago that acquired a pretty large generation portfolio about a year and a half, 2 years ago, let's say. And all of their revenue projections are massively underperforming, but the value of their fleet is up 300%. Because the replacement cost for new gen from Siemens is $2,500 a kilowatt, and they bought it for $600. And so they're losing money on the assets. The assets are bleeding cash because of, you know, oversupply, volatility, no weather volatility, low natural gas prices, all the things. But their assets are worth on their book. The book value of the assets are up size. They're worried about who they sell it to. Who's going to buy it? So the markets are in a very weird spot. And, you know, if I had a crystal ball, you know, I would be, you know, raising a bunch of capital and either getting very long or getting very short. But I do think that we talk about data centers. We don't talk enough about industrial onshoring, U.S. manufacturing, and LNG and the growth of LNG. And I think those are, you know, those are still very, very really interesting assets, really interesting opportunities. And, you know, you're going to need more infrastructure everywhere. And so you need people, you need equipment, you need gen sets, you need transformers. I think one of the cool stories that we didn't talk about is everybody's looking for the same piece of equipment. They're all looking for high voltage, medium voltage transformers. Well, who's going to make them? Where can you get them? Where are they? I mean, are they 1 year away? Are they 6 years away? If you build a new facility here in the US, can you get funding? Can you build advanced manufacturing? Can you make it happen fast enough?
It's so mad because, you know, only 5 to 10 years ago, so transformer plants were losing money and closing down, yeah. Right? In the UK, we lost a couple of huge, structurally important transformer manufacturers. And now, of course, they're the most in demand thing.
And we're still seeing very like broken models. Like we see grain-oriented steel plants being shuttered and retired. And that's, we need that for electrical steel. We need different coal to make that steel for transformers. And we're not seeing, like, Cleveland Cliffs is like, you know, a $10 stock, right? They're having real trouble. And so we're not seeing growth in coal prices. We're not seeing growth in met coal prices. We're seeing retirements in grain-oriented steel manufacturers to make critical infrastructure. You need critical infrastructure to build data centers, build LNG facilities, build transformers, build substations, build transmission lines, build everything. You need how do you mobilize all that at once? Even with an executive order around energy emergency, it's not a wartime, you know, all systems go. It's still very much like, well, I'm going to fight that. And well, I'm the utility and I don't really want that. And we're not getting that. This is a multi-stakeholder.
Hasn't mobilized at all yet.
No, at all. And people are tinkering with, oh, well, we're going to change how the FERC queue works. And we're going to change how the first come, first serve. We're going to change how we're going to squeeze a couple pieces here. We're going to put a little pressure on the NRC. We're going to put a little pressure on the EPA. It's not enough. This is a multi-stakeholder process. You know, it's funny. I saw somebody comment that it wasn't fair that ERCOT was an open market because it's preventing new nuclear facilities from being built. And they don't have any clue what they're talking about. They're basically positioning for re-regulation of this industry. And these are tech guys that make money from deregulation, not re-regulation. So they're advocating for not a competitive market. They're advocating for they're saying the open market is preventing new technology. And I just don't think they understand economics. They don't understand how this system works. But literally, I wanted to respond on LinkedIn because he said, it's not fair that it's an open market, open access market. It allows all technologies. And if we want solar, if we want nuclear, we should close it off and just charge a high price. Like, okay, that's not how this works. Like, that ship sailed. So you miss the boat on that one. But you're getting a lot of people that are non-sophisticated in this category that think they can just, you know, have a view and express a view with capital, and it probably doesn't work out so well.
So now I'm going to go to the last two questions. The first one is there anything that you want to plug for our listeners who tend to be electrification people in the US, Europe, and Australia?
It's a kind of an all call for really great entrepreneurs and people who want to be founders. We're always in the business of looking for partners, and Montauk Climate is in a really great position to go build the next set of like category defining businesses. So yeah, look us up, come to our Climate Week event. We're having an event in New York last week of September. Martha Stewart happens to be the keynote speaker for that event.
Awesome.
And we're doing some really fun things. We've got a great team, and yeah, love to meet anyone, and yeah, just kind of nerd out on all things electron economy.
And now for my favorite question. So you did talk about a contrarian view a second ago, and I hope you've got another one. So what is your contrarian view? What do you believe that not a lot of other people believe?
I mean, my team would kill me for saying this. I think we can make coal clean.
Okay. All right. Let's do this.
Yeah. I think that if you look at if you believe the story of requiring unlimited energy, you're looking at a lot of money flowing into new technologies that are unproven, like fusion, new fission, new SMRs, MMRs, you know, new light water reactors, Gen 4 reactors. I would advocate that you could probably spend a reasonable amount of money figuring out how to do sequestration at existing coal facilities cheaper and bring back a lot of jobs into like the market, into like, you know, basically, you know, blue collar jobs in markets that already have this infrastructure. And I think you could probably do it for less than what we're spending on advancements in commercial power generation in unproven technologies. That would be my contrarian view. That's my personal view. I'm not a coal bug by any means, or a coal, what's not a bug, a coal bull. I don't own any coal assets. Full disclosure, I have no exposure to any coal in my portfolio.
I can confirm you've walked in very clean today.
That's right. There's no coal silt. There's a Zoolander, you know, he's in like the coal mine, like, you know. Again, I'm not advocating to like, you know, for coal miners to come back to the US, but at the end of the day, I do think you have tens of gigawatts of legacy assets that are very, you know, environmentally destructive and pollutive. I think if we could figure out how to manage the coal ash, and I think if we can figure out how to do sequestration at sub $100 a megawatt, I think you beat new nuke, I think you beat new fusion, and I think you actually, in many cases, could beat new natural gas.
I've got a bit of a dirty secret, which is that I really like coal plants. As an engineer, I hate what they do to the planet, and I hate how much they pollute and all of that. But as an engineer, when you go and walk around one of these kind of 1960s, 1970s coal plants, it is just, it's so aesthetically pleasing, for one. And then they are just such complicated bits of equipment that if you are an engineer, you just can't help but be wowed by the amount of technology advancement in coal plants, yep, especially modern coal, yes, plants. You know, essentially burning the fuel as if it's you burn it like it's a liquid. Yes. It's just so cool. But yeah, I think I am quite glad that they're shutting down.
Yeah. I mean, they're again very environmentally insensitive. I wrote an op-ed called "Make Coal Great Again." It didn't get published. It's okay. Again, that's kind of my like little kind of contrarian view, that lots of infrastructure, there's so much, the rail system in the US was built for coal. The transmission system was built around high density mega coal facilities. If we could figure out, there's a company called Mantle based out of MIT, and the CEO who runs it is like one of the most impressive guys I've ever met. His name's Cameron. And I would have loved to invest when I was at Riverstone, but we couldn't get there. He's built a molten salt sequestration platform that is able to hopefully reduce carbon by like 98-99%, and reduce some of the stack emissions rates. And I think he's backed by Shell and a bunch of other big investors. But you know, again, I don't want to belabor the point here. But if you could figure out how to clean the coal stack, you've got gigawatts of assets that are available, readily available, and and a lot of people ready to work in the Cole. So I think if I could bring Cole back in my like twisted mind, I can bring Cole back, then I would run for governor of like Pennsylvania or Virginia or something. Cause I'd be like, listen, I created all these jobs.
Yes,
that's right. I brought it back. But no, that's kind of me just joking around. But anyway, that's a bit of a contrarian view.
All right. It was so great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for taking the time to sit down with us. We talked about a lot of different topics. So if you want to find out more about Evan and the company and some of the companies they're investing in and creating, then we're going to put loads of links in the show notes so you can go check them out. Do come and find, we'll both be here for New York Climate Week, so come and say hello. And if you want to get in touch with Evan, then you absolutely should do. And so thank you for joining us.
Thank you.